This is Jeff Blankfort, and my guest today on Takes on the World is Kenneth Cern, Professor Emeritus of Literature and Professor of Religion and Critical Theory at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. His teaching areas have included Anglophone literature outside of England, philosophy, both analytical and continental, critical theory, Marxism, state theory, and international political economy. Most recently, he has brought his faculties to bear on Britain's new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, about whom he has written several informative and entertaining articles for Counterpunch, where he's a frequent contributor. A welcome, Professor Kenneth Cern, to Takes on the World.
Glad to be on your show.
Well, it's a busy day today. I couldn't have conceived our interview being more timely. Last week on Counterpunch, you wrote an article titled Boris Johnson's Brexit Helter Skelter. This morning we learned that with the Queen's approval, Johnson has suspended Parliament, taken completely out of the Brexit debate. Could anything have been more helter skelter than that?
No, absolutely not. But Boris Johnson, if you want to put it politely, is a maverick, and if you wanted to put it less politely than that, he's a chancer and a craven opportunist. So take your pick. There were signals that this was forthcoming. I don't know why people are surprised, because if you look back to the prime ministership of Theresa May, which was not too long ago, she made several attempts to get some kind of deal, at least the outline of a deal, past Parliament, but she failed on several occasions. And the EU has made it clear to Boris Johnson that he will be offered the same deal that they made to Theresa May. So basically, they put him up against a wall. The only option that he had was to go for a no deal, which it looks as though it's done, or else capitulate to the EU. And of course, if he capitulated to the EU, the hardline Eurosceptics, as they're called in his party, would rebel and instigate a no confidence vote in Parliament, which Labour will join in almost certainly, and he'll be thrown out of office. So he was running out of wriggle room, and being the opportunist that he is, this was the path that he chose.
His spokespersons have indicated that there's no confidence vote, he won't resign, that he will that he will call another election, but one that would come after October 31st. What will that do?
Yes. Well, he'll probably lose the election. And of course, I'm reading tea leaves here, because there's so many contingencies that have to fall into place between now and October the 31st that one can only speculate. If he called an election, I suspect he would lose it. And if he lost it, it wouldn't surprise me if Labour, which will probably win the election either on its own or by virtue of forming a coalition, if it got a minority for in the first past the post system, if it was the minority leading party, would probably enter a coalition with the Greens or the Scottish Nationalists and say that the situation had been so confused, not just by Theresa May, but made even worse by Boris Johnson, that they would go to the EU to ask for an extension on the negotiations. And I think the EU would almost certainly grant them that. But as I said, this is so far into the future, but it's a likely path that could be taken by a Labour government.
I'm going to get to Labour a little bit later, but critics have been describing what Johnson did as a coup. Would you go that as far to say that?
No, I think that's overstating it for two reasons. First of all, what he has done, even though it's pretty underhand, okay, I'm putting it mildly, it's really unprecedented in British politics. So it's more than just underhand, but it is constitutional nonetheless. The Constitution provides for the prorogation or suspension of Parliament. Now, the second thing to bear in mind when one should be cautious about calling this a coup is that he has not rammed through a no-deal Brexit. All he's done is to shorten the time frame for opponents of Brexit, specifically opponents of Brexit, shorten the time frame for them to take action in Parliament to counter any measures that he takes. So basically, he's not put up a roadblock, but he's put up, shall we say, a few boulders and fallen trees, et cetera, in the way of those who oppose Brexit. So not quite a coup, but at the same time, unprecedented in the history of the British parliamentary system. And certainly deeply underhand, because this is really an attempt to preempt or obstruct opposition to what he's intending to do. And it makes a mockery of the parliamentary system, because the people who oppose the EU say that Britain ceded sovereignty to the EU when it is Parliament that should be sovereign. And here we have people in favor of Brexit basically abandoning the sovereignty of Parliament and putting it in the hands of a leader who was unelected by the general electorate. You must remember that he became prime minister by virtue of being chosen by his party, which does not have a majority in Parliament. It only rules courtesy of the Ulster. It's in power only courtesy of the Ulster Unionists, because Theresa May had to bribe them, it's in a legal way, of course, to give her their support. And they continue to support Johnson, but he is in a minority in Parliament, heading a party that did not put him up to the general electorate for ratification. So there is something deeply underhand and troubling in this whole matter.
Well, you brought up the Ulster Unionists. Where does that leave the situation at the border between Ireland, which is a member of the EU and opposes Brexit, and the North, which is part of the UK? And when I was there back in 1970, I saw more Union Jacks than all the time I lived in London.
Well, you know, these Ulster Unionists are a phenomenon unto themselves. They are deeply tribalistic, atavistic, etc. I could run out my thesaurus using such words about them. But really, peace is what matters in the north of Ireland. And the Good Friday Agreement, give or take a few eruptions here and there, has basically brought peace to the province. And to do anything that would undermine the Good Friday Agreement, which a hard Brexit would do, would, I think, create a situation that not even the rebarbative Northern Irish Unionists would want to bring about. But who knows? Who knows?
My guest is Kenneth Cern. We are talking about Boris Johnson and his action to suspend Parliament and the situation in Britain. You wrote recently about a visit of John Bolton, you called him Bonkers Bolton,
yes,
to Johnson.
Sorry, you have to laugh,
yes.
His name is mentioned.
Is Boris counting on Trump to come to his rescue with a special trade deal between the U.S. and the U.K.?
Well, he might do that, but can't perform the rescue act on his own for simple reasons, unless he's, you know, the trade deal amounts to something like a Marshall Plan for the U.K. We must not forget that the EU, apart from the UK, consists of 26 nations. And so Britain currently has trade with all of them. Now, particularly important are France and Germany, who are more powerful economically than the UK is. So he can't rely solely and completely on a deal with Trump. He's going to have to go to France and Germany and try and get a deal with them, but also several other EU nations. And what they are going to tell him is, of course, something that they are treaty bound to do, which is that all trade with them, by virtue of their being members of the EU, has to be conducted under the auspices of Brussels. So they will tell him, we can't talk to you bilaterally. You have to talk to Brussels again if you want to do any trade with us. And, of course, we know what Brussels are going to say. They're going to say, well, you take our deal, or the deal that we offered you before Brexit, the deal that we offered Theresa May, you take that, or else no trade with France and Germany. So, of course, he's not strategic. He's not a deep thinker. He is basically a fly-by-night character on all the decisions that he's made throughout his life. And I don't think he's thinking that far ahead, but the EU is going to shut the door in his face on any trade deals with EU members, bilateral trade deals, that is. Okay, there are people in his party who are hopeless fantasists. These are the people who dream of an old resuscitation of the old imperial order, where Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and India, et cetera, will come to his rescue and offer him a favorable trade deal. This is just bonkers. And they don't owe Britain any favors. They are no longer ruled by Britain. So he's going, if he wants a trade deal with them, Britain is going to be economically weakened for a long time by Brexit. They're going to say, well, if you want a trade deal with us, here's what we can offer you, but we are equally interested in what you have to offer us. And an economically weakened Britain will just not be in a position to offer much in the way of goods for a trade deal with these former imperial domains. He is going to be in deep trouble when it comes to bilateral trade deals. Trump on his own cannot rescue Boris Johnson.
Do you think this is going to have a significant impact on the global economy?
Well, Britain is now in the second tier of the global economy. I don't think so. Now, of course, there are some variables here, you know, that could play out in a certain way and create something that would be troubling for the global economy, namely a global recession with Britain on its knees, and with the U.S. Now, you see, in a global recession, as you well know, basically the countries with the economic oomph to drag the world out of recession are China and the U.S. In 2016, a global recession was preempted by China spending massively on global. And providing an uplift for the system. But if China can't do that this time, and it's not been as economically successful and buoyant as it has been for a long time, and the U.S. is running massive deficits, as we know, then things might pan out differently. But for now, Britain, the British economy tanking on its own, I don't think we'll have enough of a drag effect on the global economy to pull everything down. You should ask.
Yes.
You should ask professional economists about that.
Well, some of them don't have a very good track record. In any case,
no, they don't. But then Dean Baker, my favorite, my fellow contributor on Counterpunch, would be a good person to ask. Maybe not the people in the business schools.
Well, you know,
they are the ones who got everything wrong before, or most of them.
There's been a number of comparisons made, of course, between Trump and Boris Johnson, Johnson and Boris Trump. Even though Boris Johnson has an extensive education, which he doesn't use very well. Well, he's prime minister, I guess you can't say that. But one of the things you wrote another article about were his cabinet appointments, which approximate those of Trump, and that people were appointed to various cabinet positions in his government that were at least qualified to be in those positions. And maybe you comment on that.
Well, I think he learned a lesson from Theresa May's experience. Theresa May tried to have an ideologically balanced cabinet between leavers and remainers. And of course, what happened is that depending on the proposal she put in front of them, they obstructed her. First one side for this reason, then the other side for that other reason, etc., etc. So she was never able to corral her cabinet behind her. And what Boris Johnson did was to say, I'm not going to repeat what happened to Theresa May. I'm just going to put placeholders in my cabinet, people who will conform ideologically to what I'm proposing, and then I will have no opposition within my cabinet. But of course, in order to do that, he had to incorporate a bunch of third raters into his cabinet, and they're only there because they're yes men and yes women. There's no other reason for it. There's no opposition from his cabinet. There'll be some opposition from his party. There's talk of the head of the Scottish Conservatives, Ruth Davidson, resigning her leadership of the party. She says she will remain a leader of the Scottish Parliament, but he's going to be... But you see, he doesn't care about the Scots. He doesn't even like them. They voted Remain in the referendum, and it doesn't matter to him if the Scottish Conservative Party ends up on the rocks as a result of this. He is an English nationalist, and his affection for the outlying parts of the islands, Scotland and Wales, his affection for them is demonstrably lukewarm.
Is it going to hurt him even more that Trump has given Johnson his approval of what he's doing publicly? Even that Trump is not very popular in Britain?
Trump is not popular in Britain, but I don't mean to sound patronizing. Britain is similar to the UK in that the level of general information about politics and even Brexit is on the low side.
You mean with the USA? Britain, you're comparing with the United States.
With the United States, yes. I mean, you know, we get these factoids put out every now and again on Huffington Post, etc., which says that about a third of all Americans can't even find Canada on a map, you know, that kind of stuff. It might be a bit higher in the UK, but I suspect not much higher. And what this whole issue has disintegrated into, unfortunately, is a bit like the English Soccer League. You're either a diehard Manchester United supporter, or you're a diehard Manchester City supporter, you're a diehard Chelsea supporter if you live in London, or a diehard Arsenal supporter, and it's disintegrated into that. Unfortunately, of course, there is an intelligentsia more substantial than there is in the United States, and it is by and large Remain, and therefore distrusted by the people who are leavers and who come, roughly speaking, from the equivalent constituency that supports Donald Trump in this country. That is people who are working class, who are suspicious of foreigners, who just like to take their holidays in good old British places as opposed to places where people speak funny languages, etc., etc. Okay, and I'm providing a stereotype here, but I think the point behind such a stereotype is that there is a fairly well-defined constituency that will back Boris Johnson, come what may, in the way that you have an equivalent constituency in this country that supports Trump regardless of what he does.
Now, let's look at the opposition. I want to shift gears. My guest, by the way, is Professor Kenneth Cern. We're talking about Boris Johnson and Brexit and what is going on in the British Isles. So I want to shift to another aspect of British politics, which has showed no signs of being abated, and that's the accusations of anti-Semitism directed against Jeremy Corbyn by the British Jewish establishment and the British media, which you wrote about a few weeks ago, which in some cases has been seems directed from Israel, which is afraid to have a British prime minister who is openly pro-Palestinian. Perhaps you could comment on that.
Well, I think the Brexit brouhaha, which has intensified in the last couple of weeks, has put that issue about Labour anti-Semitism on the back burner a little bit. I think this was largely, and I've written about it for a couple of years, this was largely something that has been confected by Blairites in the Labour Party who, for obvious reasons, want Corbyn removed and one of their own tribe put in his place. And then also very substantial, no, not very substantial, that's an exaggeration, a significant, I think that's the more precise term, a significant grouping in the Labour Party, close ties to Israel. And there's no doubt that these people are, I wouldn't want to say colluding with the Israeli embassy in London. Some people would say that that is the case. But I would say there is a certain attempt at synchronizing, shall we say, decision-making in the Labour Party with outcomes that are desired by the Israeli embassy in London and, by virtue of that, the government in Tel Aviv. So the evidence, however, and a YouGov, this is one of the polling organizations in the UK, a YouGov poll in 2017 on the question of anti-Semitism in the major political parties actually showed that there was less anti-Semitism in the Labour Party amongst its membership than there was in the Conservative Party. But there we are. The Conservative Party is pro-Israel. And as you said, Jeremy Corbyn will recognize Palestine as a state should Labour come into power. So there are a considerable number of vested interests trying to preempt the possibility of him becoming prime minister outside his party and inside his party. And then, of course, the right-wing media, and of course that's the overwhelming majority of the British media, don't want Jeremy Corbyn for obvious reasons. I mean, you just have to think of a couple of papers that are owned by Rupert Murdoch, and we know what Rupert Murdoch thinks about socialism, even if it is democratic socialism, to know that all Murdoch's media are going to be against Corbyn, and they will play the anti-Semitism card ruthlessly, drum up nonsense that has no basis in fact, etc., and try and sell it to their readership. And that's pretty much what happened.
You referred in an article about the Media Spurious campaign, and you were back in Britain and you watched the BBC program Panorama, which aired a supposed expose on Labour's anti-Semitism crisis and featured a couple of characters who were not properly identified, but maybe you could tell us about that.
What that Panorama, that's the program that I'm talking about, what Panorama set out to do was to provide, as you say, an expose of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Now, they interviewed a handful of people, which they misidentified, two people in particular. One had actually worked for the Israeli embassy in London before she took up a position in the Labour Party. Well, in the that part of the Labour Party which purports to be Labour Friends of Israel. I think that's their title. So she, after working for the Israeli embassy, started working for Labour Friends of Israel. And another person who was interviewed was someone who had received money from a pro-Zionist outfit. These are very well bankrolled, by the way. He'd received money from them. But those financial ties and Miss Rose's employment at the Israeli embassy were not mentioned by Panorama. They were simply presented, in her case, she was in tears during the program. They were simply presented as people who were brokenhearted by the anti-Semitism in their party. And Labour's response to this, I must say, now I'm a member of the Labour Party, and I'm also going to be a delegate at their annual conference next month in Brighton, England. The Labour Party provided a not very satisfactory response to the Panorama program. It said that, well, what do you expect? These were disgruntled employees or ex-employees. Of course they were. You know, I think what it should have done is to, as I suggested this in my article, is to have a rebuttal unit which would virtually on the instant after the program had been aired put out solid facts about the connections that these people had with the Zionist lobby. But simply to call them disaffected employees, I think, was on the lame side, and the rebuttal should have been much firmer and much prompter. But that program was a disgrace. I mean, the BBC in the past had a reputation, not fully deserved in my view, for being the bellwether for media objectivity, etc., etc. That's no longer the case. So Labour has to be, has to have the realization that the BBC is up to tricks like any other media organization, and is no longer the neutral referee in British politics, which it purported to be until very recently.
Well, you mentioned also that there were two of these guests had been part of an expose by Al Jazeera that ran in Britain on the Israel lobby, and it was interesting, a similar expose by Al Jazeera on the Israel lobby in the United States was pulled by the government of Qatar, which owns Al Jazeera, under pressure, so at least the British public had a chance to see for themselves on British TV what the Israel lobby was doing inside of Britain. We just have a minute, maybe a comment on that.
Well, the government in Qatar is not democratic. Now, I have great respect for Al Jazeera, and the sting operation that it performed was just a wonderful piece of work, I think. It's available, widely available on social media. I think you can get the entire five episodes of it on YouTube. But at the same time, I don't think there is a general groundswell of interest in this particular issue on the part of the British public. The Conservative Party, of course, for reasons to do with securing a political advantage, will play it up. But then when they do, Corbyn immediately has a rebuttal, which is easy to come out with, namely, what are you doing about Islamophobia, which is far more prevalent in the Conservative Party than anti-Semitism, so-called, is in the Labour Party. So the Conservative Party will use this for its advantage. The media, from time to time, will the right-wing media, tabloid mainly, will use it to, as part of its broadside denunciation of Jeremy Corbyn. And the main troublemakers actually come from within the Labour. That is this Blairite remnant that is doing everything possible to remove Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. This is such an interesting conversation, what's going on across the sea. Thank you so much, Kenneth Cerin, for being our guest today on Takes on the World. And you could follow his articles on Counterpunch. Do a search for Kenneth Cerin, and you will find him. Thanks again for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
It was my pleasure.
This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.